very happy to be with you again this morning and to see so many bright and smiling faces rejoicing in the goodness of the Lord. The brother remarked about my being young in years. I'm glad that's the way I appear. We happened to discussing that with one of my helpers at work just last week, and he was inquiring about my age, and when I told him about it, he said, "I don't believe you." So I guess he had impressions, too, of my youth. So I'm glad that I still preserve it. The subject, as the brother mentioned, that we would like to discuss with you is stewards of the grace of God. And it's against the background of the exhortations of the Apostle Peter and the words that he wrote to us in the first epistle of Peter. We will read those words for you as they are found in the fourth chapter of this first epistle, beginning with the seventh verse. "But the end of all things is at hand. Be therefore sober and watch unto prayer." That's a startling introduction to a message of importance. We won't dwell on that aspect of it at the present. We will return to that after we have said some other things. But he continues, "And above all things, have fervent charity among yourselves, for charity shall cover a multitude of sins." And of course, charity here is the deep word of love, no doubt from the Greek agape. I have to be careful about the Greek because I believe we have some Greek students here. But it means love. "And above all things, have fervent charity or love among yourselves, for charity shall cover the multitude of sins. Use hospitality one to another without grudging. As every man has received the gift, even so minister the same one to another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. If any man speak, let him speak as the oracles of God. If any man minister, let him so minister as of the ability which God giveth, that God in all things may be glorified through Jesus Christ, to whom be praise and dominion forever and ever." We thought that it might not be amiss to give a little background of Peter's life and character, that we might get the proper emphasis on the things that he wrote, for he was well qualified to write words for the admonition of the church. He was commissioned, as you know, in a very special way, such as was not given to any other of the apostles, to feed my sheep. We are introduced to Peter by the master in connection with a casual incident, as it were. Of course, no one would have realized that it was the beginning of a change of life for Peter, a change which he would never escape from again, but which he would rejoice in. But the Lord does things sometimes in a casual way without letting us know the momentousness of the implications at the time. And, of course, the reason for that is to keep us alert to the possibilities of every opportunity, of every blessing, and of every service. So Jesus, as he approached the shores of Gennesaret, saw two ships embark there, and he decided that he would embark upon one of them and pull out to shore and from that vantage point address the people who have been gathered around to hear his words of grace. And so Simon Peter owned one of these ships. He and James and John, sons of Zebedee, were partners in the shipping business as fishermen. And so as Jesus just took over the situation, walked into the ship and simply commanded Peter to take him out away from the shore to a point of vantage. Peter, for some reason or another, perhaps he didn't know why himself, had no disposition to object. If it had been anybody else, there might have been some question raised, because Peter was a man of impulsiveness by nature, and he wasn't disposed to take orders from anybody. But in this particular occasion, he had no disposition to object. And so he calmly and quietly obeyed the order, took the master out in his ship, and then was given words by way of discourse that no doubt must have been words of life as well as words of comfort to those who listened to them. And the multitude were very much pleased and grateful for what they heard, for the record is that never man spake like that man, Jesus. Well, then the Lord came to shore with the ship, and looking at Simon, he said, Simon, follow me. Well, no one else had ever commanded Simon in that manner. There was no introduction about it, no explanations, just the ordinary command, Simon, follow thou me. I shall make you fishers of men. I'm going to change your occupation. And of course, Andrew, his brother, was involved in that call, and those who were partners with him in the fisher business. But Simon Peter is the character that's focused. Our minds are to be focused on in this particular incident. Well, Simon Peter had no intention of turning it down. He just accepted it as it was given. Imagine to make such a momentous decision in such a short time. But he had the kind of character that was able to do that. He was a man of character. That's what his name implied. And so he was prepared to make such a change at the command of the Master, because he had listened to the words that the Master spoke, and he had recognized that what John the Baptist had said of him, behold the Lamb of God, which taketh away the sins of the world, and that he that cometh after me is greater than me, and he must increase, and I must decrease. Peter recognized that those words were true. He no doubt was interested in the witness of John the Baptist and had accepted it at full value. And so he had received the preparatory introduction to the great challenge that the Master was to give him. And that's another characteristic of the way God works. He prepares you for these issues. He lays the groundwork. And the truth is usually the agent that he uses to do that with. So the truth is never to be taken lightly. It may be God's way of preparing you for something in your particular experience or life, as the case may be. That is why, in association with the mission, a great mission it was, for John the Baptist, that it was said that his mission was to prepare the way of the Lord. Oh, not by organizing great numbers of people to make a parade and pronounce and proclaim that Jesus was coming. No, but in a calm and yet forceful way, by proclaiming the truth concerning him, to let them know who he was and what his mission was. He is the Lamb of God that taketh away the sins of the world. Just a calm, ordinary statement of fact, but oh, how much truth is contained in that fact. What implications surround it. And so that was John's mission, to prepare the way of the Lord. And so as long as they had accepted John's preparatory work in the proper spirit, they were made right for further blessings. But if they hadn't accepted John's work, then they were putting themselves in the way of missing the blessings that God had intended for them. And so the same is true in the antitypical picture as respects John the Baptist and the Elijah antitype, those who represent those classes. They too are given a work, a preparatory work, a preparing the way of the Lord. And in connection with that work, their mission is to proclaim a message, the message of truth. And that message has a special application at this time. How blessed and how, behold, how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of them, of him that proclaimeth glad tidings, that proclaimeth salvation, that saith unto Zion, thy God reigneth. Sounds like an ordinary, simple message, but yet there are great implications involved in it. And so as those who appreciate that message are proclaiming it, they are doing that work which John the Baptist did and which Elijah was to do, preparing the way of the Lord. Now it's the responsibility of those who hear that message and all the associated truths connected with it to receive it according to the spirit in which it is given, and to realize the importance of it, the weight of it, and the responsibility that attaches to those who receive it. If they do and receive it in the proper spirit, then they will be prepared for the further blessings, however great they may be, that the Lord has in store for them. If they don't, appreciate the message, and worse yet, if they reject it, then they are simply excluding themselves from the further blessing that God might have in mind for them. But we have to get used to these casual ways, apparently casual ways, in which God works. The preparatory messages that he gives and the preparatory providences that he arranges before he gives us the great blessing of calling us to be co-workers with him in the great plan of salvation. And so that's the background against which Peter accepted the challenge, follow me, and I will make you fishers of men. I'm going to change your occupation, but it's going to be a much more important and blessed occupation. Well, in connection with this incident, Jesus, of course, demonstrated his power, because he told them to cast their nets down into the sea in order to catch some fish. Peter replied, well, Lord, we've been fishing all night, and we hadn't caught anything. But nevertheless, we will do as thou commandest. And so they cast the net into the sea, and when they tried to pull it up, they could hardly move it for the weight, because it was just overstocked with fish. And that was the demonstration of the power of Jesus that made it a tremendous and sudden impression upon Peter. He recognized that he was in the presence of one who had all power indeed, who could control the temporal elements as well as his spiritual welfare. And so he said, depart from me, O Lord, for I am a sinful man. Oh, he didn't really mean for the Lord to depart from him, but nevertheless he wanted to make it clear that he recognized the great difference, the contrast between that which the Master represented, perfection and righteousness according to the will of God, and he himself, who although he was striving after the same, was far from the mark. And so, with those words of humility before his Master, he accepted the invitation to become his bounden follower. And so we are introduced to Simon Peter. We have a further introduction to him, which gives us an insight into the nature of his character in connection with a conversation between Jesus and Peter and his disciples about whom sayest men that I am. We have that record in the 16th chapter of Matthew. Whom sayest men that I am? And Simon Peter, he was the spokesman of the group. He was quick of tongue. That was a beneficial talent to have. It's good to have a good tongue, especially if you can use it for the Lord. Of course, you know the tongue can become very mischievous, and when it is used in the wrong purposes, it can be set on fire of Gehenna. So it's up to us to consecrate that organ for the right purposes. So Peter had a quick tongue, but it was used for good purposes. And so he was usually the spokesman of the group. Whenever anything came up, why, he would be the first one to have something to say. And usually it was to good purpose, but occasionally, of course, he would make a mistake. But on this occasion, it was one of the most blessed experiences that he had in using his tongue for the right purpose. So when Jesus asked them, whom saith men that I am, in the 16th verse of the 16th chapter of Matthew, Simon Peter answered and said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now that was against the background of other suggestions that had been made by others. Some say that thou art Jeremiah. Some say that thou art Isaiah. Some say that thou art Elijah. Well, there was nothing derogatory about those comparisons, because those were all great men. They represented the greatest product of prophets that had come out from that race. So there was nothing derogatory about the thinking of him in terms of those prophets, Elijah, Jeremiah, or John the Baptist, even himself. But that was not the point. He was greater than any of them. And even John the Baptist said that he himself was not worthy to loose his shoes. So when Simon Peter comes out with a true and correct answer, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God, that was the answer that Jesus was looking for. Because he says to him, flesh and blood hath not revealed it unto thee, but my Father which is in heaven. In other words, you must have been in an attitude of heart of communion with my Father through prayer and your earnestness and sincerity of purpose, that he had been making himself manifest to you. I think we had something along that line yesterday in one of our texts. He that keepeth the commandments is he that loveth me, and I will manifest myself to him. My Father will manifest myself to him. So apparently God had been manifesting himself to his plans and his purposes concerning his Son to Peter. And so he was able to convey that information on this propitious occasion. Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And that gratified Jesus no end, immensely. That's what he longed for, a sense of the fact and an awareness of the fact that his disciples were beginning to recognize who he was, what he came for, and the great mission that he was called to fulfill. Then they would be prepared to cooperate with him in the fulfillment of that mission and take their proper places in connection with it. And so he continues, I say also unto thee that thou art Peter. Now you recognize me, I'm going to recognize you. That's characteristic of the Lord, isn't it? Them that honor me, I will honor. I say unto thee that thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatsoever thou shalt bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatsoever thou shalt loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Well, that was a tremendous authority to put into his hands. But apparently Jesus recognized that he was worthy of it. Thou art Peter. His name implied stone. Jesus could read through him. Thou art a stone. You have character. Apparently, in the providences of God, that was what your name was meant to imply. And now we're going to use that as a prophecy of what your work shall be in connection with being a pillar in the church of God. You are a rock, small. You're just a stone, small stone. But you're symbolical of a work that I'm going to do upon this rock truth, the foundation truth that you have declared. That's the big bowl. That's the big solid rock. You're just a small stone along in connection with this picture. But this great rock truth that's much bigger than you, upon that, I'm going to build my church. That truth that you have declared that I am the Christ, the Son of the living God. And there shall nothing ever happen to undermine or overthrow that truth. The gates of hell shall not prevail against it. He is the corner, the head of the corner. And blessed are those who recognize him and accept him in that light. But those who do not shall stumble and fall and shall be hurt thereby. And so Peter, therefore, was given the authority of the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and he was to open the doors therewith. And whatsoever he would bind on earth would be bound in heaven, and the disciples, of course, shared this authority, and whatsoever they should loose on earth should be loosed in heaven. Then charged he his disciples that they should tell no man that he was Jesus the Christ. Well, that sounds like a peculiar principle. You would think that that would be something. Now, you ought to tell that abroad and make witness of that. Let everybody know now that you have discovered this great truth concerning me. Well, that's not exactly how God works. We have to understand God's ways along these matters. No, he says, see that thou tell no man but that he was Jesus the Christ. Why? Because that might defeat the purpose. There was the idea of God's plan and arrangement in connection with this announcement of this great message was not for their curiosity, to satisfy their curiosity, or to give them something to think over for just from an academical point of view and to study out, but it was going to be a test. And upon the basis of the acceptance and reaction to this test, their eternal welfare in some respects would be at stake as to whether they would have a part in the kingdom and have the inherit the great blessings for those who would recognize it, or if they would condemn themselves to have no part nor lot in this matter whatsoever. So he says, charge them to tell no man that he was Jesus the Christ, not at the present time. That was for those whom his father was to recognize as worthy to have a share in this arrangement, in this plan. Now the same principle applies during his second presence. While it is true that it is to be witnessed abroad and to be spread abroad that the Lord thy God reigneth is the important message to be witnessed abroad, we are not to be surprised that everybody doesn't recognize or accept that message. For at the same time that they are commanded to spread this message, it is also an implication involved that not many would receive or accept it or appreciate it. And so therefore he would be a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense to both houses of Israel. Now in the telling of the message, they're fulfilling their responsibility. That part they cannot escape from. But the fact that many would not appreciate it, they were not to be disappointed in, because it was part of God's plan to reserve the appreciation of it for those whom he was calling in a special way to be partakers in that plan. Then he gives us further insight into what his future experiences were to be, which corresponds and reminds us of what the Apostle Paul's experiences were. So we see that there's an interesting parallel here that no doubt his father had foreseen and no doubt had designed. From that time forth began Jesus to show unto his disciples how that he must go into Jerusalem. You remember, we discussed yesterday how that That was the bounden place of destiny of the Apostle Paul. He was set to go to Jerusalem because he recognized that there was a reason and purpose as far as the fulfilling of God's will concerning him to go there. But there were various indications that could have deterred him from that if he was so minded. They told him that he was going to have bonds and afflictions there, and that's what awaited him. But he recognized that that was not for the purpose of deterring him. It was merely testing his willingness to endure and to suffer for Christ's sake. And so Jesus now says, from that time forth began he to show unto his disciples how that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders, the chief priests, the scribes, and be killed and be raised again the third day. So Paul, in following that same pattern, was simply walking in his master's footsteps. Well, now then we come back to the theme of Peter, and we come to another incident that reveals a further insight into Peter's character. And this is in connection with the text that we had last week, I believe it was, which was a very interesting text, and we wish to read it to you. Ye ought also to wash one another's feet. Then we read the comment also. This would signify that the members of Christ's body should have a mutual watch care over one another's welfare, to keep each other clean, holy, pure, and to assist one another in overcoming the trials and temptations and besetments of this present evil world, arising from the three sources of temptation, the world, the flesh, and the devil. Only as we cultivate the various graces of the Spirit, meekness, patience, gentleness, brotherly kindness, love, can we hope to be specially helpful to others in putting on these adornments of character and purities of life, and to get rid of the defilements of the world and the flesh. Such is the comment on the basis of this text, ye ought also to wash one another's feet. Now the incident itself is surrounded by the fact that Jesus had been preparing his disciples to partake with them of the Last Supper. And in so doing, we read these words in the 13th chapter of John, beginning with verse 3. Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he was come from God and went to God, he rises from the supper and laid aside his garments and took a towel and girded himself. Now, get the picture there in order to appreciate the depth of meaning behind it. He had been gathered in this upper room with his disciples. They had come from outside as they had been traveling, walking the dusty roads, and their feet had accumulated the necessary sand and dirt and defilements that would go with the outside traveling. They were dirty. It was customary in those days to have a special ceremony of washing the feet in order to make your guests comfortable. And there had been a pitcher of water, a basin of water, especially prepared for that purpose, and it was there in the room. So it wasn't any lack of equipment to say that they didn't realize what should have been done. The equipment was right there, and the reason for it being there was well known by all concerned. So they all sat around the table, and each one looked at the other, and perhaps a little suspiciously, well, what are you looking at me for? They had an idea of what should be done, but they didn't feel disposed to do it. Now, Luke gives us an insight into the reason for that. He says, because there was a strife and contention among them. Ah, yes. Strife and contentions always create certain atmospheres that make it difficult for the Spirit of God to operate. And see, we have an example of this. What do you suppose the strife and contention was? Well, as usually strife and contentions usually are, who should be greatest amongst them? You remember how the mother of the sons of Zebedee had come and had asked the master, Lord, would it please thee that my two sons should sit one on the right hand and on the left? And the other disciples got wind of that, and they were a little upset. They thought she had a lot of nerve. Why should her sons be given special priority and favoritism over them? They were serving the master and following the master too. And no doubt that had created a little stir of speculation amongst them. Well, now who is going to be greatest amongst us here? That's a good, we might as well start finding out as long as the subject came up. And so apparently this had carried over, you see, with them. And when they entered into this occasion And a very solemn occasion it was as far as the master was concerned, but they hadn't been prepared to enter into that aspect of it. When they were here sitting around the table, the hangover from this contention about who would be greatest among them was carried with them over into this situation where Jesus was preparing them for the Last Supper. So they were entirely out of character, and they were entirely unprepared to enter into the solemnity of the occasion and appreciate the spirit of the master. And so the master was sorrowful. As he looked upon them, he recognized what their problems were. Now then the question was how to deal with it. There was no time to rebuke them about it, because that might have made them feel all the more embarrassed, and they might have resented the whole situation, and that would have spoiled it. He had brought them together to appreciate certain deep facts about himself and about their relation to himself. This was no time for strife and contention and dissension and division. No, that was the last occasion when that should be encouraged. Well, now the problem was how to deal with the situation. When you get strife and contention and divisions and arguments, you know, why, it's a difficult thing to handle that kind of a situation. If you say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing, why, you might make the situation worse. And, of course, those involved are going to blame you anyhow, even though you meant good. So you have to be very careful. And so the master set us a wonderful example along that line. He didn't say a word. He just sized up the situation, and all he did was act in a very tactful manner, but nevertheless very forceful. He, as it says, knowing where he came from, knowing that he came from God the Father, knowing where he was going, fully conscious of his own authority and prestige, decided to forget about that. He got up, took a towel, took a basin, stooped down, took their feet in his hands one by one, and began to wash. Can you imagine the astonishment of reaction on those faces as each one of them looked at him with wonderment as well as puzzlement? Why, they'd never thought about the master doing a job like that. Of course, they hadn't thought about themselves doing it either. That was a little out of the question. But then the master to do it, why, that was just a little bit too much. So they were actually and literally lost for words. There's nothing they could say. They just stood there watching. He just went through with the entire ceremony, one by one, washing their feet, doing that humble, lowly task that was reserved for slaves. But when he got to Peter, as we told you before, Peter was by nature impulsive and quick of tongue. He was the mouthpiece. He was the spokesman for the group. And so his character came out again under these circumstances. When he got to Peter, Peter said, "Oh no, Lord, I'll never wash my feet." No, he had to express something that no doubt perhaps the others felt a little of it too, but they didn't have the courage and the nerve to say it like that. But Peter spoke out, says, "No, you wouldn't have any, I wouldn't allow you to do that for me." And the master looks up at him gently, but ever so piercingly, "If I wash not thy feet, then thou hast no part with me." When Peter heard those words, he was shocked into an awareness that Jesus meant what he was doing. Because if he couldn't have any part with his master, then life wasn't worth living. He had already committed himself to that cause. That's what he meant to accept when Jesus asked him if he would be, not asked him, but told him, "Follow thou me." He had committed himself to it unreservedly. And now to be put with, to put to the test as to whether he would not have any part at all with the master, that was too much. So then he responds to the other extreme. Well, he says, "Oh no, well then if that's the case, Lord," he said, "not only my feet, but wash my hands and my head and all of me." Characteristic of Peter. And Jesus said, "No," he says, "it's not necessary to wash all." He says, "Ye are clean, but not all of you." And then he was referring to another aspect of the experience that he was about to enter into concerning one among them who was really defiled in the inward sense of his heart, not his feet. But he had no doubt started with that very one first and washed his feet first. And so you see, all of that was involved together. He was giving them very important lessons. Can you picture that situation? Washing the feet of the one who he knew was about to betray him that same night. And yet not saying a word to him. Treating him with love and kindness. And yet greeting him with those piercing eyes. Judas, how could you? Such was the master's example. And so he overcame Peter's impetuosity and got through with the ceremony, and then went back to the business at hand, which was to prepare them to participate of the Last Supper. But he left them with an admonition and also a warning. He said, ye ought also to wash one another's feet. Don't let this happen to you too often. I've given you an example. Ye ought also to wash one another's feet. Now, of course, it would require, it would be a test. Might be something that might not always be desirable, but nevertheless it would be something that would be pleasing to the Lord. And that's what Jesus wanted to impress upon them, God's view of these matters, so they could appreciate that. And so we have the explanation in the comment that we just read to you, how that applies with respect to our interest in one another's welfare and being willing to serve one another in all respects of opportunities that present themselves, and recognizing that we're doing, in so doing, we are following the Master's example of washing one another's feet. But we must go on with Peter. He had already prepared them for the fact that he was about to enter into his crucifixion. And that was what he was preparing to go forward into. Peter and Jesus had engaged in another conversation. And according to the gist of this conversation, the Lord had given Peter a chance to test his loyalty to him. And Peter had responded with his impulsive assertion, his impulsive assurance, self-assurance, that he would always be faithful to the Master. Though everyone else would deny him, he would never deny him. Jesus had brought to their attention that there be one among you who will betray me. And Peter responds, Lord, I would never do such a thing. But the others had come back with the question, Lord, is it I? Jesus then took that occasion to impress upon Peter the risks involved in these composite elements in his character. There were potentials for good, and there were also potentials for evil. And they had to be properly balanced, and he needed the warning. And so he said to Peter, before the cock crows, thou shalt deny me thrice. Well, that was a shock to Peter. Peter's reaction inwardly, though not outwardly expressed, must have been, well, Lord, you just don't know me. Is that so? Well, that's typical of all of us, isn't it? We would all think along that line. Well, Lord, you just don't know me. Until the Lord gives us various experiences and shows certain things that are helpful to us, and then we wake up to realize that, well, maybe the Lord didn't know us better than we knew ourselves. Well, that was the case with Peter. So Peter, it hadn't left any impression on Peter at the time, except that there was a negative reaction. Well, no, that would never happen. He was too sure about anything like that ever happening. But then after the incident begins to develop, the time came for them to come for Jesus, and they did. Judas did his defamatory work of betraying him and kissing him, and thus leading the authorities to put their hands on him. They took him, and after going through certain procedures, they carried him up to Pilate's hall, and the disciples were following him afar off, because they realized that there was possibilities of them becoming involved in this situation in an unfavorable way. But they were following him nonetheless, and for that they deserve praise and credit. They were interested in their master's welfare, but they didn't know how to face these complex circumstances that were developing around his crucifixion, his approaching crucifixion. So Peter was among them, and he stood perhaps a little farther off than the rest of them. He wasn't too impulsive under this particular situation. He was a little cautious at this time. And while he was there, warming his hand, apparently the evening winds were making it a little cool, so they were warming their hands around a fire. One of the women folks around there remarked to someone else, isn't that one of his followers? And pointed to Peter. And she looked at him and said, aren't you one of the followers of the Master? And Peter replied, I know, I don't know him. And he thought that was settled the matter. He probably heaved a big sigh of relief. Well, I'm glad I got that over with. But fate wouldn't have it that way, because someone else starts another conversation, and they said, again, looking at Peter, isn't that one of his followers? And they put the question to him, aren't you? And he again said, no, and then with a curse and with an oath, he denies it. No, he says, I don't know the man. And a third time, the same situation happened, putting the question directly to Peter. that you are one of his followers, and then they tied him up definitely with it. They said, why, you are one of the Galileans, aren't you? You come with that band, you belong to that band of people. In other words, they were putting you in the corner, so to speak, so that he couldn't get out. And then Peter realized that he was really in trouble, so he cursed with a loud oath and said, I never knew the man. And then when he said that, he looked up where Jesus was, and Jesus was looking right directly at him. Jesus didn't say anything, he just looked at him. And that look must have burned something through Peter's mind that left an impression on him that he probably never forgot. He hung his head and burst out into tears and walked away, for he remembered what the master had told him. Before the cock crows, thou shalt have denied me thrice. And sure enough, the cock crew at the time that he made his third denial. So the master proved that he understood Peter better than Peter knew himself. Well, he couldn't get over that right away. That really shocked him. That just unsettled him, unnerved him completely. He was ashamed. He was discouraged. He was despondent. He was in utter despair. But it was a despair. A despair unto repentance. He was sorry. It wasn't the case of Judas at all. There was no comparison. Judas was not a repentance or a regret unto repentance or a godly sorrow, but he just was sorry that he got himself involved in so much trouble without finally leaving a way to get out of it. And so there was no hope for Judas, no comparison. But Peter's was a godly sorrow. It was just the impetuosity of his, the impulsiveness of his nature that got away with him, and the circumstances were really full of pressure, and many perhaps wouldn't have done any better under the same circumstances. So we thank God that they were, that there was one whom he could use in that way to give us encouragement that when we fall and stumble, there is hope according to the sincerity of our hearts. And so Peter had that on his, as a burden on his heart. Well, we come to the occasion when the crucifixion is completed. Then comes the glorious anti-climax, his resurrection. In the meantime, Peter and the disciples had been wondering now, after the master had died, they had been wondering what was to become of their hopes. Well, they had been gathered together along the shores of the lake again, and finally they had been pondering in their minds what to do. Peter decided, well, I go a-fishing. There was that spokesman for the rest. I go a-fishing. The others said, well, we'll go with you. They were still partners. They knew the business together. So they had made a decision. So they unhooked the boat from its moors and got in, and off they went into fishing. They were going back into their old business. As for these other things, we don't know just what is to become of them. Well, they went out fishing. They didn't catch any fish. And while they were out there, they were heading back toward shore, discouraged and sort of downhearted. And a man was out there on the shore, and he says, hold there, cast your nets on the other side. Well, they thought to themselves at first, what's the use? We've been fishing all night and hadn't caught anything. Just like the incident under which Jesus first introduced Peter to the ministry of following him. But they were willing to take a chance. They thought, well, the way he said it in such a commanding and tone of assurance, he must know something what he's saying. So we'll take a chance. So they threw the net on the other side, and lo and behold, the net became full of fish. John, who was with Peter, the three of them, Peter, James, and John, you know, were always together. John recognized the significance of the incident. He says to Peter, why, that's the master, that's the Lord. And Peter looked at John, and then he looks at this man on the shore, and dawned on him right away. He was a quick thinker, you know. He said, that's right. But he was a man of action as well as a man of character. So instead of talking about it and discussing it, he acted on it. He just put on his, girded his robes about him and jumped out of that boat into the water and swam ashore to meet the master. That was Peter's characteristic. He was always the first to serve. And that's how he went towards the master. And so the rest, of course, drew the boat in and came out and waited ashore. And when they arrived, why, the master had already had the fire there and the fish were all prepared, and he invited them to sit down and dine. And then he had a special, after having a little conversation with all of them, he had some special words for Peter. Jesus saith unto them, come and dine. None of the disciples durst ask him, who art thou, knowing that it was the Lord. This is in the 21st chapter of John, 13th verse we're reading now. Jesus then cometh and taketh bread and giveth them, and fish likewise. This is now the third time that Jesus showed himself to his disciples. So when they had dined, Jesus said to Simon Peter. Now there's again, our attention is focused on Simon Peter. son of Jonas, lovest thou me more than these? He saith unto him, yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. The Lord responds to him, feed my lambs. He saith to him again the second time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? He said unto him, yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. He said unto him, feed my sheep. He said unto him the third time. Now Simon is getting a little nervous. He's a little fidgety. Now this, what does this mean? What is he driving at? He begins to become uncomfortable. Then his mind begins to go back on the incidents of the crucifixion. He's a little disturbed. And then Jesus, after saying the third time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? Peter was grieved, because he said unto him the third time, lovest thou me? He didn't know whether maybe the master was making fun of him or embarrassing him or just what the implication was. But of course that wasn't the master's intention. And so in order to reassure him of his true intention, that was the reason he impressed on him three times. Peter says, he said unto him, Lord, thou knowest all things. Thou knowest that I love thee. Yes, he knew that Jesus could read his heart. Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. Verily, verily, I say unto thee, when thou wast young, thou girdest thyself and walkest whither thou wouldest. But when thou shalt be old, thou shalt stretch forth thy hands, and another shall gird thee, and carry thee whither thou wouldst not. We're going to change that character, that impulsiveness, that impetuosity. We're going to mold it into different channels. It's going to be a greater character for all of the testing and discipline and polishing. Now, what did he mean, lovest thou me more than these? Well, this business that you were so devoted to, that's your life work. I know you're so used to that. There's a natural attraction to that. These boats, they are to you represent the symbol of your life work. Do you love me more than these? Are you willing to forget about your life work and life ambition and aspirations, even all of that for me? Lovest thou me more than these? You see, the others had followed your example. Now, are you going to give them the right example? Lovest thou me more than these? Do you really love me to that extent? You say you love me. How much do you really love me? And, of course, he just wanted to focus Peter's mind on the reality of his earnestness and at the same time remind him of the things that he would have to watch against. And so Peter was thus officially given the office to feed the Lord's sheep. And thus he was restored officially into fullness of favor with his master, with the assurance that all of the past would have been forgotten and would have been all of overruled for his good and for the benefit of the church whom he was to serve. Now then we come to our context in Peter that we were reading to you a while ago, where Peter gives us these very effective words of admonition that carry so much weight, we believe, especially at this end of the age. Fourth chapter of 1 Peter, where we read to you the seventh verse, but the end of all things is at hand. Peter had been talking about suffering in this chapter. For as much then as Christ has suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves likewise with the same mind that he that has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. And so he's been talking about the thinking it not strange concerning the fiery trials that are to try you as though some strange thing had happened unto you. He had already had enough experiences to get him familiar with the master's pattern. So now then he brings his admonitions to this climax. But the end of all things is at hand. Be therefore sober and watch unto prayer. Now why should he have said the end of all things is at hand? Was it true? Even though 2,000 years has elapsed since that time? Why yes, if we have the proper understanding of it. But of course it has its peculiar application at this end of the age, when it has a literal sense in which it can be understood. But it was true then too, because for them they were looking forward to the consummation of their hopes. And the consummation of their hopes would end, so far as they were concerned, at whatever time they would have made their calling and election sure. So it was their responsibility to be daily endeavoring to make their calling and election sure, and so from that standpoint, the end of all things was at hand at any time any one of them would have made his calling and election sure. And that's what their minds were to be concentrated on. So that it had an appropriate application to them even at that time, and to any of the church who can see it in that light. Peter recognized in his own case that his days were numbered. And many of the others of them recognized the same thing. They were all suffering and called to suffer, and they were going to go through trials and experiences that meant that their days were numbered. And so as far as they were concerned, the end of all things was at hand for them. For as far as the world was concerned, it didn't mean anything to them. But of course it has, as we say, a literal application at this end of the age. It is true not only in the sense of all who are endeavoring to make their calling and election sure, but it is true in the sense that the end of the age is now where we dwell, and that the consummation of all things is the due order of God's plan at this particular time. The heavens and the earth, which are now, are due to perish, being on fire, are to melt with, the elements are to melt with fervent heat. For there is to be a new heavens and a new earth to take its place, to supersede it. So in that sense, it is literally true that the end of all things is at hand. Therefore, he says, watch and be sober, and watch unto prayer. In other words, to be specially diligent about thinking along these lines. And if you do, he says, there are certain appropriate thoughts that will impress themselves upon your minds. And these are the thoughts that he wanted to bring to their attention. Above all things, have fervent charity among yourselves, for charity shall cover a multitude of sins. Now that was the experience that the pastor himself, who was the author of these comments that we read this morning in our text and the text that we also read, he had also to watch one another speak, that was the experience that he literally entered into in connection with his closing days. And so you'll find in the last four years of the reprints from about 1913 to 1916, that you have a concentration of articles on this same subject of charity. Love. Loving the brethren, even loving your enemies. Building up love among yourselves. It's the same spirit of the admonition that Peter gives here. Have fervent charity among yourselves, for charity shall cover a multitude of sins. For Russell, the pastor, foresaw that there was going to be a great test along these lines, and that the results of the test was going to be a lot of trouble and heartaches amongst the brethren. So you see, he enters into the spirit of the Apostle Peter's admonition that during this time, when the end of all things is at hand, it would be especially important to develop this particular grace amongst God's people, the grace of love, having love among yourself, for it shall cover a multitude of sins. It will enable you to overlook a lot of troubles and dissatisfactions and dissensions and so forth that might, if they be not properly overlooked and covered with the mantle of love, develop into troubles that could bring great distress upon yourselves and upon the church at large. So that's his remedy for that possible situation. And it's not a possible situation, but it's a certain situation. For that would be the characteristic of the end of the age, not only in the church, but in the world too. In the last days, perilous times shall come, men shall be lovers of pleasure, more than lovers of God, and heady, high-minded, self-willed, and disobedient, and so forth. Well, that would be the spirit of the age, and it would creep into the church if the church wasn't careful. That's why they had to be careful along these lines. Use hospitality one to another without grudging. That would be good. If you got into the pattern of looking out for one another's welfare, that will change your viewpoint. Instead of developing the contrary spirit of finding fault and seeing what you can find to pick on in your brother, you look at him in a different way. You'll see him from the point of view of one striving to serve the Lord after the manner that you are, having to meet the same obstacles, the world, the flesh, and the devil, struggling in a narrow way, not having many to uphold him, having forsaken the world and knowing that Christianity is not going to misunderstand him, nominal Christianity, so he's not going to have many friends. So you'll recognize that you're all in the same position, and therefore you'll develop an attitude of trying to help him out because he's in the same boat that you are. And that will be good for you. So he says, use hospitality one for another. That will cultivate the attitude of looking out for the interest of your and welfare of your brother instead of seeing how much you can criticize in him. Because if you start to criticize him, you're bound to find something to criticize because he's not perfect. See? So that's a sure thing. But he says he doesn't want to encourage that because that might be dangerous for the welfare of the brethren involved. Use hospitality one to another without grudging. And he says, as every man has received the gift, or you've got something that God has given you, a gift. Well, what is that? Even so minister the same one to another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. Now then, he's bringing to our attention the thought that you are stewards. And it is required of stewards, Paul says, that a man be found faithful. Now, how do you become stewards? You become stewards because all that you have, you gave away. Now then, the master gives you certain things back. And he blesses you with many blessings. And that's the grace and peace that these epistles are always introduced with. Grace and peace be multiplied unto you. That's the favor and blessing of God. Now then, according to the degree that God gives you these various favors, you become stewards of them. If he has blessed you with a nice home, if he has blessed you with financial wealth, if he's blessed you with good health, if he's blessed you with automobile, if he's blessed you with talents of one kind or another, he says those are things over which you become stewards. Now he says you are to use those things for the welfare of your brethren in Christ and for the glory of God. And so in that light, he says, you become stewards of the manifold grace of God. The grace of God is manifold. He doesn't give it all to you and doesn't give anything to me. He gives us all something. I may not have as much as you, but I'll have something. There's the one talented man as well as the 10 talented man. But they all were required to use what talents they had, whether 1 or 10. As a matter of fact, he found more fault with the 1 talented man than he did with the 10. Because there was not much danger that the 10 talented man wouldn't use his, but there was a little danger that the man who thought he didn't have any talents might not use it. He's the one that went and buried it. And then the master came to reckon with these ones to whom he had given these various talents, and the one who had 1 talent said, well, he says, you know, I knew you were a hard master, so I just wrapped it up in a napkin and I buried it, because I wanted to be sure I had that 1 talent to give back to you. And the master said, you said you knew I was a hard master, that's true, why didn't you put that talent to usury and get some interest with it? And so that's the thought that he wanted to impress upon them, that they should use whatever abilities they have, whether humble or greater, but to recognize that God has given each one of them something to be used for his glory in the ministering to the brethren. So therefore we are stewards of the manifold grace of God. So then he says, if any man speak, let him speak as the oracles of God. Let him recognize that perhaps God may be blessing his words according as he is in harmony with the will of God. If any man minister, let him do it as of the ability which God giveth. That, and this is the objective of the whole plan, and he wants to leave that impression with them, that God, in all things, may be glorified through Jesus Christ, to whom be praise and dominion forever and ever. May the Lord add his blessing.
Thank you, Brother Jacobs, for that illustration of grace as found in the life of Peter. And may we conclude this service with the use of hymn number 21, the first and last verses, and may we all rise just for a little exercise. Hymn number 21. I look upon it pretty much as we would look upon a menu. That is, I come to a convention just as I come to a dinner table, hungering and thirsting for satisfactions and for needs. And so as we have looked upon our menu, we have many